This presentation is mostly visual images because the premise of art therapy is that images do speak better than words, for it, particularly with children or particularly with anyone who's having problem communicating verbally, and that is often the case when there's been any sort of trauma. The images are from quite a long period of about 12 years when I worked under a social work team where I was brought in to work with children who were going through the fostering adoption process. And there had been an attitude that children should be settled in placement before therapeutic work was attempted. But as many of you probably know, children are often going through the process for a very long time. And often the neglect or abuse has happened at a very early stage in their life, which is actually pre-verbal. So talking therapies are not always the best way to begin. There may come a point where talking therapies, various art therapies, art activities, all of it's valuable. And I mean, as a company, Creative Therapies work with artists and therapists. So we often find that the combined approaches are the best way to work. Not present, and I'm no longer working in social work. I'm now based in the Royal Hospital for Children in Glasgow, sadly no longer called York Hill, which seems quite sad that we've lost the name. But what I'm working with at the moment is children with heart conditions. And in every, label we give a child, it's complex. There's a foster child part of the group. There's children from a huge deprivation. There's children from huge wealth. You know, I think it's like abuse. It happens in all families, so it's not just about deprivation. But at present, I'm working on an animation, our second animation. And what I've just discovered by accident, that working on a small animated film with children is a wonderful way of introducing group work, because each child can produce an element. Say perhaps at the moment we're working on a wonderful story about a rainbow, and this is all written by the children, where a rainbow loses colour because someone steals the colour from the rainbow. And you can imagine if you've had something happen, like you've been diagnosed with a heart condition, the world's a great place. You know, you probably can't run, you can't take sport, there's so many things you can't do, and you're different. So I think in some ways, the arts, these wonderful, wonderful young people have seen, all the arts are about inclusion. And I think when we work with the arts, with all kinds of children, what we see that every child brings something to the group. But I think the thing with the visual art is children have a space, particularly in group work, where they can work individually in a private space and then come forward to the group. And what they're negotiating is that more private space and more combined space. So I think that's where sometimes, I'm sure it's the same, Moira is a very well-known music therapist. All the arts have this capacity for going inward into our own world, producing something individual, but then contributing to a bigger group. And the animated films have been an absolute eye-opener to me, because the first one was about children making an individual tree and then making a forest, making a creature, then making all kinds of creatures. And we have a very gifted animator who combines it all. So I think that working with the therapist, working with the artist, you know, I don't think any approach is better than any other. It's just about what the arts bring to children, particularly children who for some reason feel that they're not quite part of the crowd. So we're going to look now at images from fostered and adopted children. And I've brought two small, I personally believe that visual images will always say more than anything I can say. But these are two little images that were made by a child going through the fostering and adoption process. And I was so lucky in the work I did in that I was not time limited. I'm not sure that would be the case today. There's so much pressure on therapeutic work because the posts aren't there, which is probably why I've ended up in a hospital. You know, that in social work it's been cut back so severely. But I was really lucky that most of the children and the work you'll be seeing, these children were with me sometimes for 18 months, 2 years, sometimes longer. So there was a chance to really get to know them. Because I don't think therapy happens, and it doesn't happen until there's a relationship. And when we have a very damaged, frightened child, the relationship does not happen overnight. And I think we'll start to see with some of the images here, the slow work of building trust with a frightened child. So the common I'm sure this is all familiar to many of you, but I'll just run through it. The common characteristics of children facing adoption, emotional, behavioural, and also their attachment styles. Hypervigilance, low self-esteem, poor concentration, impulsivity, high-risk behaviour, no sense of self, poor at forming relationships, challenging behaviour, socially remote, hypersensitive attachment disorders, and inappropriate boundaries. And the inappropriate boundaries can be immediately tactile. And that can be quite difficult when you have a child that's very needy of affection, but you know that that's not always helpful. So how to encourage a child? You know, the thing that you hold the child moving sideways, that you can do it through the warmth of the gaze, but you know, a child that will say in the first session, do you want me? Can I come home with you? No, all that completely, there's no boundary there because I've never been shown. So I think all of that's part of the work. But I think when you have the art medium, you do have somewhere, if there is difficulty in the relationship, it can just recede into the work and we can wait until things get better. And children often ask me not to talk, you know, for struggling. And you can sit and work away and slowly the mood lifts and it's better again. Oh, these awful phrases we learn. But David Howe, I don't know if any of you know his book, a very good book on attachment, abuse and neglect. Parent and child find themselves in a loop of catastrophic feedback leading to a state of emotional hyperarousal and behaviour that becomes hopelessly out of control. Hostile, helpless, or rapid switches between the two. These are the mental states we find in maltreating parents and maltreating children. And of course, this comes into the therapy space. Neglect is an insidious form of maltreatment. And I think it used to be thought that neglect was the lesser of abuse. But I think we're realising now it's equally as dangerous and sometimes worse in some ways because it's pervasive and it's ongoing. Sometimes with abuse, there's moments of love and tenderness, and there might be a switch into cruelty or abuse, but neglect is pervasive. So there ends up with a feeling in the child that the child just does not matter, and that is so damaging to the sense of self. And that's when we talk about another child that has no sense of self, because they've never felt that they existed in the mind of another. Psychological unavailability. And you can see these children who are prematurely mature. They just don't believe that there's an adult there to offer help. And this is looking at the characteristics of neglected children. Helplessness, passivity. They don't seek or ask for help. Low self-esteem, a lack of trust, and very disorganised. It's what we also see in the art world is incredible chaos and mess. And children of severely neglected parents internalise a hollow, empty, abandoned self. Acts of omission, physical, emotional, cognitive, educational, social or cultural. The parents who never turn up for parents' meetings at school. You know, the ones who are always there, the ones who probably don't need to be there. The teachers will tell you that. You know, some parents never come. And very often their children are the ones who are overlooked. And the need for feeling safe is our most basic need. And feeling unprotected is frightening. And fear is the most powerful, primitive, and dysregulating of the emotions. Some of you might have seen one or two of these images before. There's been other talks, but I have made a collection of photographs of palettes. You know, palettes to me are a record of the session. And I think this one you probably realise is out of focus, which is not usual for my... there was something happened that day that somehow, you know, I couldn't focus. Very good camera. But I felt there was something about this image that was also about the internal state of the child. And what's happening here is that this colour on the palette, this pale blue, and I think it was black and green, but the child spent the whole session working around the palette and scooping with her fingers from one well to the other. And although there was, you know, beautiful paper sitting, somehow the paper wasn't used. The child couldn't make that jump from working on the palette to working on the paper. And of course what I felt was the usual irritation adults feel and children don't give us what we think we need or what we want. And then I realised that this child was triggering off in me what we call counter-transference, is that this child isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, it isn't giving me what it should be giving me. And I realised I had to really shake up my own thinking. And I also realised that the palette is the image. Now, how stupid am I? The palette is the image. You know, it's the most beautiful thing once you open your eyes. So I think it's about being with a child at that moment in time and accepting whatever the child brings you. And I think that's something we can bring to whatever work we do with a child, is that acceptance that the child is doing his or her best, and what the child brings is certainly good enough. But we have to open our eyes to see what is in front of us. Usually at the start of therapy with children, there's a period where there's a lot of attack. It might be on the actual therapist through mess. It might be through throwing things. The child's very frightened to be in that situation, very odd situation, being alone in a room with a rather strange old lady, not quite sure what they're doing there, not sure what they're expected to be doing. So you can see the child's in a terrible place of anxiety. And if a child's language is to launch missiles or launch themselves at you, that's what the child will do. So my way of working is, if there is a deliberate attack in the room, this image is accidental. You know, it was just a big tray of slurry, a mixture of clay and sand and water and paint, and stones were being lobbed into it, so it was splattering. But that was not a deliberate attack in the room, it was kind of accidental, kind of neglectful, you could say. But, you know, if a child's actually attacking me as a person, you know, they're throwing things, I would simply say, I think we'll stop there today and we'll start again next week. And once that's done a couple of times, it stops. Because the child wants to be there, but there's absolutely no help in me becoming irritated. Absolutely. As soon as I feel that there's enough, we just stop. But we start again once that's, you know, it's the same when I'm working in the hospital. If we have a big mess, I might take the paint away one week. I might remove the clay if it's been used for what I would call an unhelpful catharsis. If it's simply attacking the space, you know, you can then guide the child just by, not by, this is all non-directive work, there's no themes instructed, but you can suggest by the use of what materials are made available. So it might be clay sometimes, or it might be drawing, something that's a bit more reflective and peaceful. It might be sewing. If a child's very upset, I would make sure I had lots of tactile things, you know, soft pom-poms, little bits of fabric. There might be feathers, you know, all the nice button boxes are wonderful. Watching a child endlessly sifting, and you know the child is thinking. There's something about pouring little buttons into little tiny containers. It's all container work. So the child sees what belongs where, might start sorting into colour, sorting into shape. So there's no direction, but you can see you have nice materials and interesting materials. There might be some bits of straw. It's an image we'll look at later where there was, I think, straw within the image. So just it's trying to tune into the child you're with, seeing what's best for them, so that you don't start with a programme. You see what the child brings and what the child needs and try and work that out together. Then this, you can see there's been a huge attack on the image, which is quite sad. When you see a child, every mark they make is never good enough. You know, they make one tiny mark with a pencil and they say, oh, that's wrong, and then they rub it out. So every mark they make tells them that what they do is not good enough, and that's a very painful place to be with a child. And of course, you know, maybe our first initiative might be to help them, do it for them, you know, get them to colour in, get them to trace things. But, you know, how helpful is that? You know, I don't think it is particularly helpful. You know, I think there might be some of that at the start. You know, the child might say, can you draw something for me? And I would probably say, I'll start the drawing, you finish it. You know, just trying to help a child who's in that awful place that everything they make is not good enough. How do we get them to begin? How do we give them the confidence to make anything? And I think that is a very, very slow process sometimes, and it's painful watching. But, you know, and it's treading that line where we're not being an intrusive type of adult who says, no, I'll do that for you, and then further disempowers the child or allows the child to struggle in a way that isn't helpful. So I think that's one of the difficulties as a therapist, you know. walking that line between taking over and disempowering, but also feeling like another abandoning adult. So I think that's the type we're walking as therapists. I just love this picture because what happens with palettes, I suppose you all know that when you mix colour, the world is always brown. It's, you know, every colour mixed together turns into brown, which I think is an amazing thing. You know, I still find that, you know, why does that happen? Where did the rainbow go? But if you mix all the colours, you get slurry. So this is what happens if you turn over a palette that's had every colour of the rainbow on it, and you mix it with your hand, you get this kind of muddy brown colour, which is the earth. It's also feces, you know, it's these materials do bring children very, very back to early childhood. And that working with mess, there's some very interesting papers. There's a wee reading list I've put out. There's a very good art therapist called Caroline Case, another one called Frances O'Brien, who think that working with this kind of mess and the hands and the paint does take children back to very, very early pre-verbal memory, and it does help repair some of that early brain damage where the synapses weren't linking because there was not enough stimulation. You know, a lot of analysts think that the child comes into therapy very often at the age when the damage was done. So a child might present as 10, 11, quite competent, playing sport, but then when they start the art materials, you see they're very, very immature and young. And I think it's then pacing them through the stages that they need to negotiate. I'm sure you've all heard the phrase regression in the service of the ego, Ernst Chris. You know, the child has to go back to go forward. So it's having that's why the therapy has to be very boundaried, and in a room which there's no intrusion, where the work is all kept for the duration of therapy, it can be looked back over the period of therapy. The child can see themselves how far they've come. So I think that's why the work's always retained. That's difficult sometimes for children. No, they want to take it home, they want to show the teacher. But what you have to say was, at the very end, when you're finished, you'll have all of this work, and you can choose who comes to see it. You know, social workers do often come, foster parents, parents, perhaps grandparents, and kinship care might want to come and see what they're doing. And that can be easily managed, you know, so the child is starting to show something that they're proud of, rather than this child who's always been seen as not quite good enough. That's a wonderful thing when a child invites perhaps, you know, a parent or a foster parent and a teacher and perhaps a social worker, come and see what I've been doing. Like this little boy, you know, he was an amazing child, but very silent. You know, we had long sessions when there was almost nothing spoken, but busyness. And that lovely phrase, can you help me with this? And he's talking about the play, but, you know, how many levels is that? What does he need help with? You know, his father's vanished, his mother's mentally ill, he's been through serial foster placements. Fortunately, he's got a wonderful social worker, he's got a wonderful head teacher. You know, he was so impulsive. His social worker used to walk him what he called the long mile. He'd walk from school to therapy. By the time he came to me, he'd run off some of that energy, and he was in a good place to start sitting and thinking. But, you know, all these different adults working together for that child, that's when it works best. Not therapy in a room that nothing comes out. The same child making... I don't know if any of you have ever tried to glue down a pipe cleaner. It's not easy. It takes a lot of glue, and it takes a lot of determination. So eventually he managed to make the square. But, you know, watching that struggle, you know, it's stringing up, you know, it's just not happening, and I'm holding one end, and, you know, just all of that. I mean, it's quite funny in retrospect, but, you know, the frustration of that, and the fact he's not losing his temper, you know, he's not leaving, he's not sort of hurrying across the room, he's sticking with it, and eventually... And then he's done it. So, I mean, I think that's just marvellous. And the child, as that says, he's fought his demons. That's resilience. There's so much resilience in making with your hands. You know, what happens when it falls to bits? What do you hurl it across the room, or do you pick it up and try and make it work? These are lessons for life. You know, if things don't go right, or something falls to bits, what do we do? Is it a relationship? Is it a piece of play? Is it a friendship? Is it a school? You know, all these things. You know, I think through that persistence and keeping trying and having the courage not to give up, that's when children start to realise they've got that, you know, what I would call the inner hero. And I think there's one or two images of the child's finding that core, and then they ask what they want to make a shield, and they want to make a sword and a helmet, and they're getting their armour on because they're out to fight their battles. You can make all these things in a therapy space. So it, of course it's a kind of enactment of something, but what it's teaching a child is they have that core and they have that armour and they have that courage. And the, I think there's something, I made wonderful cardboard shields with children, and one child put on the shield him and me, you know, and I think that was his shield. You know, he'd come from this wee boy, 5 or 6 years old, removed from home in a foster placement. You know, it was a wonderful foster placement, but it was up a farm track. This is an urban child. You know, so how does he manage? You know, he's had to move school. He's in a terrible place at school. He's so aggressive, all the other children. He's bigger than most of the other children. He's hitting everybody. And sometimes when I go in, he's under the teacher's desk barking. And I think this child is just about teetering on a psychosis. But, you know, he does come back from it, but it takes an awful lot of work. You know, unpicking the work of neglect and abuse takes a long, long time. And then I think I might just say that what took me into working as a therapist was I was the art teacher in Berlin for 9 years. And that's when I saw the impact of neglect when it isn't addressed. So that's a very expensive business when we have, I think there's something like 3,000 men in Berlin. And some of them you're quite glad they're in there. But almost all of the ones I met had been put into care as children, the ones who were really causing havoc. So I think, you know, let's put the resources in early. Let's put the arts in early and give these children a chance, because children don't stay children. A damaged child becomes a dangerous adult, I think. Scattering. I think sometimes it's important just to have tubs of things that can be scattered without too much damage, you know. But this lovely wee boy was in... I think his whole family, when I met him he was 5 and he was repeating primary 1 because they reckoned he'd learned nothing. And I think that's what happens when there's that amount of neglect and abuse at a very, very early age. And he was in a very unsympathetic foster placement that fortunately changed, and once the foster placement became more supportive and understanding of him, he really blossomed. But I was with him for a couple of years where he was in a foster placement where he wasn't managing, a school where he wasn't managing, and he was just a bit of a wee lost soul. But he ended every art therapy session by emptying out the paper clips, or it could be buttons, something that's easily gathered. And he always said, "Sheena, I'm sorry, I can't help this." And I said, "I know, you've had an hour of feeling I can understand you, and now it's all falling to pieces. You know, the world's falling to pieces again." So I think to have these little tools, you know, there go the paper clips, you know, it becomes funny. You know, that's his ending ritual. Back to a world that doesn't really make sense and that doesn't contain him, but he's not contained in the mind or the heart of any other adult. But to have the tools and have to make sure we've got the stuff, you know, pom-poms, it takes 2 seconds to pick them up. So I should make sure you've got the big ones, you know. But, you know, there's something... That gesture told me more than any question I could ask that little boy, because it was a ritual that repeated every week. Once a child who's been very neglected and abused starts to trust an adult, this terrible anxiety, you know, becoming close to an adult might mean danger, it might mean threat, it might mean loss. Well, these children have lost their families of origin, and there's always that ambivalence, and often there's an idealisation of the family of origin, and that's a terrible split. They start to believe that none of that stuff happened. They blame the social workers. How could my mummy hurt me? How could my daddy hurt me? So sometimes the family of origin, which there's no contact with, is idealised, and the foster or adoptive family are taking the blame. And I think that's a very, very difficult one, and it might go on for a long period. And there's some very, very interesting books written on these subjects, and I think Dan Hughes, if you know about him, writes about attachment, nurturing attachments. Some children are so hard to place, so hard to work with. But this is something that starts to happen in therapy. The child suddenly jumps and ties the therapist to the chair, masking tape. So I've always got big pockets, you know, I've got my scissors on me. But, you know, you can see that's coming from a real place of anxiety, and it's often just before a longer break, say the summer holiday, there's suddenly this impulse. And you know, it's an opportunity to talk to the child. Don't worry, I'll be here in 3 weeks' time. I know you're frightened, but you'll manage. And what happens is, over the break, the child manages without the therapist, and that's really important. That's as important, or perhaps more so, than being with the therapist. They found a core that helps them survive the break. When they come back after the break, you see a child that's grown in every way. So I think that's why breaks in therapy are important. There might be, you know, long weekends, it might be the Christmas break. You expect some kind of acknowledgement that it's a break. There might be a bit of an attack before the break. They might not come to the one after the break. They leave you before you leave them. But it's just time to understand what's going on in the child's mind. And then working a lot with string. So I always have lots of string and wool, pipe cleaners, attachment materials. And you can see, these were kind of puppets, but you can see how they're attached. And you know, if a child's making a puppet, there's so much we can talk about. How does it feel to be a puppet? You know, other people pulling your strings. And then the children that are very good at losing their temper, we can talk about who pulled your string today, what happened in the playground there. You know, all of these things have got lots and lots of meanings. This is classic Winnicott. You know, I don't know if you've read The Piggle. He writes a lot about the meaning of string. And that's something I see in therapy all the time. You know, when particularly with groups of children, when children, or one child particularly, will run string or cable round all the furniture, sometimes with the other children inside it, and sometimes we've got to get permission for that, you can see what's happening there, holding the group together, holding the room together. And sometimes it does start to look a wee bit psychotic, because the strings are going round taps and sinks and chairs and doorknobs, and it's like the Matrix. And if you've read about psychoanalysis, we talk about the Matrix. And sometimes that's recreated in the therapy space. And you must remember, these are children. They haven't read, you know, books on psychoanalytic thinking. This is in them. This is what happens when a child's stressed. And you see it enacted in therapy spaces constantly. And I'm always amazed at what children know and what children teach. This is the same little boy, you know, who was doing the scattering. So we've moved from scattering to a kind of very insecure attachment and a very anxious attachment. And I think we're on our third therapy room by now, because he'd moved family, he'd moved school, and I'm following him about, and we're trying to always find a place to work. And sometimes we worked in the school, sometimes we worked, and this was a social work room that belonged to a disability team. They had a really lovely art room. I was so fortunate that they made it available, because all it seemed to matter was that we just kept working until eventually it seemed to have settled enough. That would have been 2 years worth. No, polystyrene balls and pipe cleaners, just thinking about linking, thinking about connecting. And then there are little planes with string, they're actually tied together, thinking about bonding, pairing. Couples, twosomes, you know, they have all these simple objects create a conversation, and possibility of a conversation. And it's coming from the child's thinking processes, and also that, can you help me with this? Can you tie the knot? And then you're opening up who we're connected to. That's me looking my best. But I thought that was really nice, the child making a drawing of me. And I would imagine that would have been before a break as well. and this is another, the same child. But this is the boy that walked the long mile, who made these. He wanted me to draw us on a motorbike together. So you can see sometimes this joint work going on. There's a phrase in art therapy called the third hand. It's an American art therapist called Edith Kramer. She's one of the first art therapists in America who saw the position of the art therapist being the third hand, that you're there to help and it's too difficult for your client or your child. You know, if the problem seems too big, then it's almost slightly autistic. You take your hand and it holds things, or it sticks things, or you know, you're just there to be used as a kind of alternative ego in a way, until they feel good enough to do it themselves. If you want to ask me questions as we're going along, I'm quite happy to receive questions. Or will I just go through the images? There's an awful lot of them. I usually let children make the sign for the door. This is interesting. This is a child who's neglected but also sexually abused. Sheena does not want mysterious visitors. But who's Sheena? Who knows, is that us as a couple? Or is it Sheena shielding the child? And then this is by Sheena. Then anyone that enter when not wanted, then this line going up, is in deep trouble. Then it says, my privacy counts as well as yours. I mean, if you think for a child that's been sexually abused over a long period, 4 years, and then removed into foster care, and then the relationship with the mother was rehabilitated, you find that sexual predators often target a very vulnerable woman. So the mother was also very much a victim, but was not at one point being straight with social work. So the children were removed, and then the family was rehabilitated. And I worked with 3 children from that family, and it took years. And the input was massive, but I would say it took a long time, but that family stayed together, and it was wonderful. Eventually seeing mum out on bicycles with them, and just a mum. But sometimes she joined the sessions as well. That might happen occasionally, but at the child's invitation.
When you say
join
the session, did she play?
Yes, very much so. The child, quite often when children had long periods of therapy, for perhaps the last month or two, they say, can mum come? It's almost like they know that they'll be handed back to mum, and it's important that mum is part of that process.
So in terms of the third hand, does the mum play the third hand?
I think there was one... That's a very interesting case, because the child asked the mum to join the session, and mum didn't really like talking about the sexual abuse. There was a lot of avoidance, and I think what the child wanted to do there was bring mum into the session so she could talk about it in front of me to her mum, and mum felt safe enough. And there was only one session when the child made a clay vagina which was bleeding. Mum at the same time was making this very pretty picture of flowers and a lot of, kind of, you know, this is what art therapy should be. It should be all beautiful and lovely and none of this horrible stuff. But I noticed that the girl had started to giggle in a rather hysterical way. I couldn't see what she was doing. And then she said to her mum, remember when I had blood in my pants? I think she needed me to witness her confronting her mum, because I think they couldn't really have a relationship until that was acknowledged.
Wisdom
of that child. But, you know, I think sometimes I wasn't the third hand there, I was the other ego that protected both of them. But I thought that was how, I mean, sometimes children just blow you away. They know far more than we ever do. But we have to be open-minded to let it in. So I like that one. That's a very, very badly behaved teenager. You can see it's sanctuary and the middle finger. But I actually asked them, how do you know that word? Sanctuary apparently is a computer game. So that's what went on the sign in the door. But I liked the way he could relate the computer game to the safe space. He'd made that connection. I mean, that's what starts to happen in therapy. Links. That's why these polystyrene balls, that could be, brain cells, it could be anything, it could be a family, but we're making links all the time. But I liked the fact that the sanctuary meant he was safe, but it also said get lost. He didn't want anybody else coming in when he was a twin.
It's also saying privacy. It says sanctuary.
Sanctuary.
It's very half sanct and half privacy.
No, it's very dyslexic. Sanctuary.
Can I ask a question about supervision, you know, as a therapist? Will you take the young person's work to your supervision?
Yes, or images.
And images.
Everything's photographed with the consent of the child or the parents.
Yeah.
So the images, I prefer to take the real things, but if they're fragile, I wouldn't.
Yeah, because I'm just wondering if the learning can be even more enhanced.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as soon as I am with a good supervisor, I see all the stuff I missed in the session.
Yeah.
And I see it before he even notices.
Yeah.
I need that other mind to help me function.
Yeah.
So we're very, very highly supervised. You know, so usually I've got at least two, perhaps three supervisors. There might be in social work, there'd be an online social worker.
Yeah.
I'd also have a psychodynamic supervisor who's usually either a child psychotherapist or an art psychotherapist. So I need somebody who can help me with the images, but I also need somebody who can help me with, say, the child protection and the families, apart from the dynamics. And so they, you know, we're very, very highly supervised, and you can see you can't function at all without it.
Do you ever offer some of that back to the client? What you've gained?
Well, sometimes they know I'm taking work.
Yeah.
And they ask, what did they say?
Yeah.
And you just say, they thought it was amazing. You know, but, you know, I supervise other therapists, and I sometimes say, the one particular therapist works in a prison, and I say, can you tell them that the work's amazing? Because I know in a prison, you're so starved of stimulation and the response that I know it's important for that man to hear that he's locked up for life, but he's, you know, you can see that it's through his artwork he's living. But I think just to have that little comment going back in, he doesn't know my name, but he knows that I've seen his work and thought about it. Yeah, well, I think supervision, if we weren't highly supervised, we'd be breaking all our ethics as art therapists, and also we're HCPC registered, which is very, and in the hospital obviously we're highly supervised. Another child, do not disturb for 25 minutes, and it's an hour session, I don't know why it's 25 minutes, but that was probably his concentration span. Chat before enter, please. But I thought of bringing this today, but it's rather large and rather heavy. This is a child, really, it's a beautiful story, but rather sad. It started with the left-hand side, which is the Golden Farm. And this is where he lived with his family, mum, dad, and a brother and sister. Dad had severe mental health problems, and there was quite a lot of alcohol involved in rural Scotland. We've already heard of, you know, what happens in rural Scotland. There's a lot of alcohol abuse, it's a lot of loneliness and all the rest of it. But anyway, mum and dad split up, and then dad committed suicide. So you can imagine the guilt, you know, in the children and the mother. And then I'm afraid mother hit the bottom, so this boy ended up in foster care. And he came and did amazing, amazing artwork. So there was the Golden Farm, and then the right-hand side is actually a stable, and there's two little horses in it. But you can see that could be him and mum and dad, him and a sibling. But there was something, this was a grieving piece of work, the grieving for the family of origin. And I think sometimes what happens in adoption is that the children are encouraged to forget about the family of origin, and I don't think that works. You know, so I thought, so this boy had all this time to grieve, and I met him, he came back into therapy, he was in primary 7, and first year when he did the first piece of work, but when he was 14, 15, he requested to come back. Because by this time he'd asked to go into a children's home because of the craziness at home. So he ended up fostered. But I kept the farm. And then I just said, guess what? And I had it in the cupboard and I brought it through. He said he had nothing from his childhood. He'd moved so many times that he'd lost, you know, the memories. That is an amazing thing. So, I mean, I am showing that with his permission, because I actually wanted him to take it. He said, Sheena, I don't know what will happen to it, will you keep it? So I mean, I still have it. Now you're seeing it, that's that boy's journey. He must be 20 years old now. These are images for sexual abuse. Do not touch. Put the mucky stuff in a tub and put the lid on tight. You know, that's talking about it at the same time. Most of the children, when I meet them, the disclosures have been made. So, we're not seen as diagnostic. We're seen as part of the healing process. That's really awful. Bruno, dad, did the toilet on his puppies. On his puppy. Here's proof. Signed the king. He's writing us. He'd gone a bit omnipotent at that point. But there was a wee puppy. So you can see this is an enactment of the sexual abuse. This is an instance of supervision. What happens if things are getting a bit difficult and I'm not understanding? And a supervisor said, if the child's in the mess, and that's often with a little figure or the dog pushed under the muck, make him a ladder. It's so simple. But I made a wee ladder and then the wee figures could climb back out. I think that's why we need the other mind thinking. This was quite a long piece of work with a child of addicts. Dad had died and mum was struggling. He was in a very, very good foster placement, but spent a lot of time with me. You know, these bleeding eyes, a lot of spiky drawings, strange the way the circles around the, you know, the sump and the cross. You know, these drawings that are very complex. Dad and mum are gone away, was what he'd written, but was unbearable, so he added out, you know, as if mum and dad had just gone out for a while. But, you know, dad had died and mum, you know, she was off the radar. So, the frozen heart. I'm just trying to get to the. I like Star Wars a lot. Little boys use Star Wars a lot, and it's actually Oedipal. If you think about Star Wars, you know, the child that murders his father. I think it's important for therapists. Children are bringing you stories. I mean, I sat through every Star Wars film ever made, but I do know the story. And there's stuff about, you know, the confusion between father and son, and these old stories do come back. I think it's important to know them. It's Darth Vader. A nice paper by Caroline Case, Cutting Out, Cutting Away. You know, when the child asks, she had made a drawing of her mother, same little boy, made a drawing of the mother, and then asked me if I could cut it out in one piece. What's happened here is the figure's been removed and it leaves a gap. Working with dolls, when we work with dolls, if the child's being abusive to the dolly, the child has its own dolly kept in the box. So if dolly's getting a bit of a bashing, it's not ever given to another child. You know, that's that. And, you know, what the child's showing us at that point is how it feels to be an abused child, but how it also feels to be the abuser. So the child's swapping between the cruel role and the vulnerable role.
Can I just ask about the doll then? Because that doll is kept for that child.
Yeah.
They work in that doll, so no other child
uses it. Sometimes the doll, this child had a wound on the tummy, and that could be the heart, and then I think another child, part of the foot was cut off. You could never give that to another child. So this was, you said, that's your dolly, and how you treat that dolly is up to you. Mm-hmm. So you can see them swapping between lovely tenderness but then cruelty, and then you can see what they're showing you is part of the experience. And that was a supervisor said that, make sure that dolly is just for that child. The glasswork, this was a wonderful case. I'm only going to talk for another 10 minutes and then we'll have questions. I like glasses, obviously it's transparent. Two little boys who were found abandoned, I think the older one was two, he'd been keeping the baby alive with dried cereal and water. I don't know, he didn't manage to kill that baby. But then fostered and finally adopted. And another image of cutting out, cutting away. And then important to read the notes thoroughly. He'd poured yellow watercolour onto a big pad of good quality paper, and then afterwards he said to me, did you know I didn't have a bed when I was a baby? I'd done my homework and knew that. So I said, that's a terrible memory. But I got something what we call counter-transference to the image, which means when I went to move his pad of paper, it felt like a wet, saturated, cold mattress. And it gave me such a shudder. So I think sometimes the transference is in the image as well as in the relationship. Working with dolls' houses, you know, you can see the jumble. That I always like the doll's house to be completely ordered at the start, so all of this has been tumbled by the child, and the dinosaurs, the furniture, it's complete. There's no sense in that house. Everybody's lying down. Is that what the child sees when they wake in the morning? I don't know. I just say, you know, this child doesn't have the verbal capacity, but they are thinking. You know, you're aware of the mood, the quality of the silence. I might be taking notes as the child's telling me a story. I also saw a lovely, this one's just the boy with the mattress. He had a very good foster mother. Children often work with impermanence, which means they're working with sand or glitter on a tabletop, knowing at the end of the session this will be swept away. And what this little boy had done was had, as a final statement, had put his mother's, foster mother's initials in beads on top of the glitter. So I felt there was a moment of connection. But then he asked me to sweep it into a big cardboard box, but he climbed inside and said, "See an entire ball around me." And I didn't actually feel that good about it. You know, I thought he was a parcel. But someone else said, "It's also a gift." So this is fairly recent work. This is a child who was, I also worked in the psychiatric ward in the hospital. A child who was coming in for really fetal alcohol. So she had developmental problems and quite a lot of delay. She was removed from the family at 2. But she wasn't coming to art therapy for grief work. But I was quite surprised to see what she was working on was the grief of the family of origin. And I think sometimes in a new foster family or a new adoptive family, there isn't the space. You know, children feel if they're talking about the family of origin, they're being disloyal to the family that is now caring for them. So I think that's why it's sometimes important to have this other space to maybe do that work. And what was noticed was this child's anger management was radically improved by this work. I just think she felt she had all this stuff that she couldn't process. But I just think that it's the most beautiful piece of work. Started off with drawings, and you can see there's no ambiguity because she herself has written "Mum above the baby work bird." It's not me saying this is the family of origin.
She don't call the adoptive mother mum.
Sorry?
She don't call the adoptive mother mum.
She did by now.
So it's that.
But I asked her to say to her, "Which mum is it?" And she said, "My original mum." You know, I think that's why these drawings. I mean, if I'd asked her to talk, she wouldn't have gone there. But sometimes over that period of forming a relationship, I remember there'd been lots of work up to this point, painting and drawing, working in a group, lots of work. But then suddenly she manages to approach something that's probably lying under the surface. And then moving to clay. I use clay a lot. It's probably, that and paint are probably the most important materials for me. It seems to take children quite deep. But I think it's also to help them manage where they're going with it. This was a difficult. This is a huge 3D structure she's made. She first of all made the birds on their little, almost like a ground, a floor, but then she made this and fitted it over the top. So it was a complicated thing to work. I mean, she's 13, she's a wee bit older than most of them, but she'd made a window and also a door that you could lift out so you could look in. So there was something about snapshots of the past. You could look in and then you could close the door, which meant she could mediate how long she looked and how much she looked. And I think, I felt the sadness in the room was really palpable when she was making the work. And then the door was put back in place. Now, I think it's important sometimes that there is room for anger. I, in some ways, prefer an angry child to a sad child. I think anger promotes change, sadness goes inward. So I think when you have a child that's very sad and depressed, if they finally get in touch with their feelings. There could be an outburst, but you know, quite often sad, lonely children are not really on the radar because it's the angry children that get the attention, but they're just as much at risk. In some ways it's more at risk because they've kind of given up. You know, the baby that doesn't cry is the baby we worry about. The baby that screams for someone to come, there's hope. They expect someone to come, but a baby lying not crying, that's a very, very frightening baby. The baby thinks there's no help there. It's that structure. And you can't really go with this. That's what you feel when you see these images change. I mean, this could be months of work. You know, endless mess. And you really think you're stuck, it's not going anywhere. You know, it just feels like endless repetition. But I think it's just waiting. Well, Winnicott says a wonderful thing about premature interpretation is stealing from the child. It's about our own cleverness. I think it's really important to let the child come to the idea of what's happening in their own time and in their own way. And they will if you support them. But I think to come in with a premature interpretation, you'll shut the child down then. And they might be going to something you didn't really know where this is going. So I think it's why sometimes the art therapy is very slow. But I think it promotes change that lasts. And because I think of the images and the memories in the body. And you know, these are images that are now in the mind. And a good image can cover up an image that is more frightening. Yeah, and there's a lot of, you know, body work. Like that's a big thing when a child's painting with both hands. You know, it's opening up the chest, means they're breathing, they're not anxious. You know, and when the child's in control of the room, you know, you can see that it's functioning, the mess is on the paper. It's not splattered all over the place. To have the courage to admit that you're helpless, admit that you've not got very many friends. And this little boy had no friends. I mean, I can't thank that head teacher enough. In the middle of all his tribulations, he made him school captain. And that's why he actually stopped coming to therapy, because he said he couldn't come to therapy because he had to be in the playground to look after the little ones. And what a good head teacher. Trusted that boy, and I think he needed. It's not a therapist. Nobody believes in that. Therapist says, "Well, you might tell the child they're wonderful, but it needs the head teacher to come in on his side. Then he's really validated." And I think that was great to see that boy. Can't come to therapy now, I'm too busy. No, it's just, but that was brilliant. But I think it's so important as well as therapists that we're always at meetings and we're feeding back and we're doing long reports. We're seeing what we see. And that's feeding into the, you know, the social work or the school or, you know, I think everybody's working for the child. Swords, crowns, and there's the shield. That's the one. Yep. That's a child with his therapist. You can see that is about, you know, a child who'd been really badly hurt by a parent, not really physically hurt and neglected, but really physically badly hurt. You know, you can see you need to think that you've got some strength about you. Now that shows you, you know, I'm in my lovely room, but you can see how it's, you feel as if you're in the middle of an earthquake. Everything is taped together. Kind of mad, making a den. Just have a nice den. Sometimes these children come in from school and they are exhausted. You know, maintaining that level of control when you know, you might not know where you're going to be living in a couple of weeks. Trying to focus, you know, and trying to focus in school. Sometimes the session would start. The art therapy would start with a nap. And they weren't really sleeping, but they were lying down. And they're absolutely exhausted. They might not be sleeping, you know, there's nightmares, there's bad dreams, they're hypervigilant, they're awake at the least sound. So I think, you know, a nice den's quite an important part of a therapy room. And the child will make it themselves if you don't provide it. separation and loss, the ability to separate from the painful past, a sense of something missing, and then the work of therapy, looking at these kind of mixed up but painful images, a lot of weeping, crying, tracks, mixed up wounds, blood, just all sorts of jumbled images, hard to make sense of them. And that's the end. Just wanted to show you these. You know, just this boy was amazing. I'm sure he's an engineer by now. Everything had to work. So we always had to find ways to make things work. I mean, I don't know if any of you have worked with clay, but all of these, it's just, sometimes it was so painful watching, trying and trying and trying, and it wouldn't work. And then eventually it would, but I thought this wee guy was amazing. How to make clay wheels, and we're back at the Flintstones here. How to make a clay figure. First of all, that will stand on a skateboard, but then you can actually move. You know, I mean, that is clever. And I think we also made a clay train that ran along a track. I mean, I think I must have aged about 20 years with that, but I've got really nice... You're making a clay track where every single segment is made with clay and put together. There's a track, and then there's a train with carriages. They're all joined together. That is resilience. How many times did that fall to bits? How many times did he try again? But I think that's where all the arts, I'm sure Moira would be able to say about learning instruments and children contributing, that not giving up